If you will turn in your Bibles to Romans chapter 4, we're going to pick up with Paul's logical presentation as well as theological argument in this text concerning this whole business of Abraham's discovery. The opening question of chapter 4 is, what shall we say that Abraham, our father, according to the flesh, has found? Translated in some translations, forefather. In the studies that we have done in chapter 4 up to this point, as we are down now to verse 11 and perhaps 12, but probably not tonight, we have seen that Paul is really adamant about the fact that Abraham discovered the blessedness of being a human being in the position of being uncondemned by God. Being in a position as a fallen human being and discovering that God refuses to acknowledge his sin. He will not take their sin into account, verse 8 says. And he talks of David out of Psalm 32, who writes of the blessing of the man to whom God reckons righteousness. And as we've said, Psalm 32 is on the heels of the Bathsheba event. So David was writing out of his own personal experience, having sinned grievously, discovering that the fellowship that God offers to people is genuine, and it's on the basis of a righteousness that is not founded upon human performance issues. Now, that doesn't mean that human performance things are not important. None of this theology of justification by faith apart from performance issues means that the way we act is not important. That's obviously not true. Galatians 6, which is in the end of the book that argues in the New Testament most strongly that justification by faith apart from performance issues, in that book, he tells us to be careful about the seed that we sow because we will reap as we've sown. So it's not that our behavior is not important, it's just that our behavior is going to be guided by the things we believe. And if we believe that our righteousness springs from our behavior, then our behavior will be terrible. It will be atrocious. It will be massively hypocritical, because that's exactly what the Jews had believed, and that's why in chapters 2 and 3, Paul nailed them. And he could do that as a former Pharisee who knew all the intricacies of Jewish thought and theology. So he's absolutely adamant about starting at the right place, and that is that you do not attribute the relationship that God extends to you by grace to your performance issues, because that's not true and it will lead you into massive failure if you buy into it. Now, one of the sleeper issues that is involved within our studies is the fact that Paul raised the question of Abraham's discovery in chapter 1 as our father. And this evening we're going to see it more as a sleeper issue, because up to this point it's not really been clear what it means for Abraham to be a father. But in verses 11 and 12 and following, Paul makes this point that the entire scenario of God's plan is designed around the issue of Abraham's ability to be the father. He says in verse 11 that he received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had while uncircumcised, that he might be the father of all who believe. And then in verse 12, and the father of circumcision to those who not only are of the circumcision, but who also follow in the steps of our father, Abraham, which he had while uncircumcised. And then if you drop on down to verse 16, it says, for this reason it is by faith that it might be in accordance with grace, in order that the promise may be certain to all the descendants, not only those who are of the law, but also those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all, as it's written, a father of many nations have I made you, in the sight of him whom he believed, even God, who gives life to the dead and calls into being that which does not exist. And in fact, verse 18, in hope against hope he believed in order that he might become a father of many nations. So, you get the point. The focus in this chapter, even though it's kind of slow getting there, starting in verse 1 but then not really dealt with again until we get down to verse 11, the issue has been, in Paul's mind, from verse 1, this business of Abraham's identity as the father of us all. So, Paul just, basically, he goes as far to say in verses 16, 17, and 18 that it was the promise that Abraham believed. That was, he would be the father of many nations. It was that promise that was the focus of his justification. In fact, in Genesis 15, 6, where we're told point blankly that Abraham believed God and it was counted to him for righteousness, that's the text that Paul appeals to in verse 3 and goes back to in verse 9. That text is the text in which God told Abraham, come out here and look at these stars. And if you're able to enumerate them, believe this. That's what your seed's going to be like. And when Abraham believed that statement, he was justified, if he hadn't already been justified earlier in chapter 12. But the text of Genesis 15 is in the context of a promise of his fatherhood. And when he believed the promise, he was justified. Or at least that's the connection that's made in that text. So, what this boils down to is that God has always had a plan for a vast kingdom made up of many nations, and his plan was for Abraham to be the father of those who make up that kingdom. So for our study this evening, we're going to jump into this, what I've called a sleeper issue, this business of being a son of Abraham, because the relationship we have with God on the basis of faith is an Abraham issue. In fact, I just was reminded of a text over there in Galatians. Let me find it. You can turn to Galatians if you'd like, and when I find it, I'll tell you where it is. It says in chapter 3, verse 29, something that almost sounds backwards in Galatians. It says in Galatians 3, 29, if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring. Now that almost sounds backwards. It almost sounds like it ought to be, if you belong to Abraham, then you are Christ's heir. But that's not what it says. It says, if you belong to Christ, that qualifies you to be Abraham's heir. That's really interesting. Which, because that statement made that way, makes the fatherhood of Abraham a very big deal. It makes our relationship with Christ an instrument to that end, instead of our connection to Abraham being an instrument to the end of being connected with Christ. It's the other way around. That's a very interesting twist on things. And now I think maybe you can see why the Jews were always willing to fall back to this fallback position. We're Abraham's offspring. That was their basic fallback position. We said this several weeks ago, but when John the Baptizer began his ministry and the religious establishment started having to pay attention to him because the numbers were just flocking to him, and the massive numbers in Judaism that were flocking to John would always catch the attention of the religious establishment because they were into church growth movement things too, and they were always jealous if somebody else was getting a bigger crowd than they were. So, if somebody was attracting huge crowds, they wanted to figure out how they could get in on the front line of that, so they decided that they would come out to John and be baptized by John and get identified with John, and then the people, you know, then they could maintain their position of leadership within the people that were flocking to John, and John just point blankly said, you brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come? You bring forth fruit worthy of repentance, and we'll talk about baptizing. But in that context, he said, and do not tell me that Abraham's your father. And what he is doing is he is addressing their fallback position. In John chapter 5, the Jews say, we're the offspring of Abraham. And Jesus says, I know that, but, and we'll get into some of that this evening. But that was their fallback position, because just like the Apostle Paul in Galatians, being connected to Abraham was fundamental to the plan of God. We're going to see tonight why, but That's why I kind of called it a sleeper issue, because as we worked into chapter 4, we really didn't get into the fatherhood issues until now, as we get down here to verse 11, where it tells us that he received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had while he was uncircumcised, so that he could be the father of both the uncircumcised and the circumcised, in verses 11 and 12. It was God's plan for Abraham to be the father of everybody who believes. That's verse 16. Those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. And verse 18, the father of many nations. So, what is this whole business of Abraham being the father, and why is it so important? Well, the thing that I want to start with is a general biblical pattern, and I'd like for you to hold your finger here in Romans 4, because we're going to come back here, but I want you to go all the way back to Genesis chapter 4. Because it is in Genesis 4 that we begin to get the first hint of the significance of a father and son issue in the scriptures. In Genesis chapter 4, Moses is obviously, he's writing this, he's 2,500 years into human history by this point, and they've had revelation from God through prophets like Enoch and Methuselah and some of those guys before the flood, and then there were people like Melchizedek after the flood, and men like Abraham. There was divine revelation in the world, but as far as a written record, Moses and Job probably were the two earliest writers. Job perhaps the earliest of all, being a contemporary perhaps of Abraham. But Moses, 500 years after Abraham, wrote Genesis. And in chapter 4, he just makes this kind of a summary statement when he's giving the genealogy of Cain in verses 16 and following. He gets down to verse 20, and he tells us, because in verse 19, Lamech had two wives. One was Ada and the other was Zillah. And it says in verse 20, Ada gave birth to Jabal. And then he makes this comment. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. And then in verse 21, and his brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the lyre and pipe. And as for Zillah, she also gave birth to Tubal-Cain, the forger of all implements of bronze and iron. And the point that he's making is that if you're a musician, you're a son of Jubal. If you're a nomad, you're a son of Jabal. If you're a mechanical engineer, you're a son of Tubal-Cain. Now, you got to know that this being pre-Diluvian stuff and being the lineage of Cain, none of whom survived the flood. All the line of Cain perished in the flood. The only people that survived were Noah and his three sons, and they were of the lineage of Seth. So the entire offspring of the lineage of Cain perished when the flood killed off all of humanity except those on the ark. But Moses says, another 1,000 years after that, that if you're a musician, you're a son of Jubal. What's that mean? It certainly does not mean that you're genealogically connected. But it does mean that the issue of fathers and sons is connected by behavior, not physical generation. You ever heard the statement, like father, like son? What they're saying there is that fatherhood has to do with setting a pattern, and sonship has to do with following it. So that you could be the physical son of somebody, but if you don't follow their pattern, then you're not their son in the sense that often the Bible addresses it. Now we know, if you want to go from Genesis 4, we won't be there anymore, so you don't need to keep your finger there, but jump over to John's Gospel from there. Clear over into John's Gospel, chapter 8. I misquoted the text a while ago. I said John 5, but it's 8. In John chapter 8, Jesus is going head-to-head with some of these people who continue to insist that their physical generation from Abraham makes them special in the eyes of God. And so you know, Jesus is dealing with these kinds of people, and it tells us pointedly in his debate with them. He said in verse 31, if you abide in my word, then you're truly disciples of mine, and you shall know the truth, and truth make you free. And they answered, we're Abraham's offspring. Abraham's our father is what they're saying. And we've never been enslaved to anybody. How is it that you say you shall become free? Now, when they said that, they were under Rome's dominion. So apparently they had some kind of a non-material concept of being enslaved, because they obviously were under Rome's physical dominion. And they understood the implication of Jesus that they were in bondage somehow, but they're claiming that they've never been enslaved. So how can you say you'll become free? And he says in verse 34, what I'm telling you is, if you've committed sin, you're the slave of it. And the slave doesn't remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son makes you free, you'll be free. Really free. And then in verse 37, he says this, I know you're Abraham's seed, yet you seek to kill me, because my word has no place in you. I speak the things which I've seen with my father, therefore you do also the things you've heard from your father. And they said, Abraham's our father. He said, well, if you're Abraham's children, do the deeds of Abraham. But as it is, you're seeking to kill me, a man who has told you the truth, which I heard from God. This Abraham did not do. You're doing the deeds of your father. And they reared up and said, we're not born of fornication. And that was a deliberate jab, because they'd heard the stories about the fact that Joseph wasn't his father. They didn't believe the virgin birth stuff, so this little sliding slash, we're not the ones that are born of fornication implication, but you are. I mean, it was deliberate, and Jesus just said, if God were your father, you would love me. And then he said in verse 44, you are of your father, the devil, and you want to do the desires of your father. He was a murderer from the beginning, and that's basically what he's accusing them of, trying to kill him. Now, my point is this. In John chapter 8, Jesus is using the Genesis 4 concept of fatherhood. He is basically arguing, if God were your father, you would mimic his pattern. That means you'd love me because the father loves me. If you were the sons of Abraham, you would not be trying to kill me because Abraham didn't do that. Your real father is the devil, because he's a murderer and a liar, and that's what you are. So he's basically taking the Genesis 4 construct that takes fatherhood and sonship out of the genealogical realm and puts it into the pattern mimic realm. The father sets the pattern, the son mimics it. Now, Paul did the same thing in Romans chapter 8. He said, those that are led by the Spirit are the sons of God. He did not say the children of God. He said the sons of God. And the reason he didn't say children is because he's talking about father-son. Sons are reflectors of their father, and Paul says that's only going to happen if you are led by the Spirit of God. So that you can be a child of God and not a reflection of your father, but you can't be led by the Spirit and be a son and not be a reflection of your father. And of course, that's what he was arguing in John 8 when Jesus said, if God is your father and you're his son, then you'll do what the father does. He loves me, so you'll love me. And since you don't love me, that proves you're not one of his sons. But that's the theological argument. And in Hebrews chapter 1, the author of Hebrews makes it very clear that sonship means making manifest the character of the father. Because the son in Hebrews 1 is the outshining of the brilliance of the father's glory. So all the way through Scripture, you have this dual line of things going on. You have the physical lineage issues, which are genealogical connections, and you have people claiming special privilege through physical connection. And then you have the biblical concept of father setting patterns and sons following them. And God doesn't operate on the physical level. He doesn't let you be a son of Abraham because you can trace your genes back to Abraham. If you want to be a son of Abraham, according to Romans chapter 4, you have to believe like he did. And that brings us back to Romans chapter 4. So the issue in the scriptures, a fatherhood and sonship is the issue of the father setting the pattern or establishing the original pattern and the son mimicking it. Now, that means then that the issue of sonship is going to be the issue of identifying the critical characteristic of the father that is being mimicked by the son. The key one. For example, in John 8, Jesus acknowledged that his opponents were the seed of Abraham, but immediately challenged the significance of that kind of sonship. Physical generation sonship. He immediately challenged it. I know you're Abraham's seed, but you're really the devil's. And because of that, he pointedly highlighted a characteristic of the father that they would mimic if they were his son. And that characteristic was, if you were of my father, you would love me because my father loves me. In other words, the characteristic that he highlights in John 8 is that one. Your attitude toward me, Jesus said. Because I know what my father's attitude toward me is, and therefore any son of his is going to have the same attitude toward me. So in any given text, the issue is, okay, what's the defining characteristic of the father that is mimicked by the son? In Genesis 4, if it was Jabal, it was musician. If it was Jubal, it was nomad. If it was Tubal-Cain, it was worker with iron and that kind of thing. Those were the big characteristic issues that the father set the pattern for, and the sons were the ones who mimicked it. So, in Romans chapter 4, the argument gets really, really tight because the downline consequence of the fatherhood issue is the question, who are the sons? And that's what Romans 4, 11, and 12 is about. Because he's going to identify the chief characteristic of the parent, the father, and he's going to argue on the basis of that characteristic who the sons are. Now, one of the things that we need to understand about Romans 4 and Paul and writing in relation particularly to Jewish mindset, because in verse 1 of chapter 4 he deals with his father according to the flesh, so he's still wrestling with his Jewish idea that if you can trace your genealogy back to the right person, then you're his son, and that makes you theologically safe. And Paul would say that's not true. There's no truth to it at all. But that's what they believed, so he had to deal with it. Now, one of the issues about Jewish theology was highlighted, and is still highlighted, though it probably doesn't carry the same weight today as it did in the first century, but it was bar mitzvah. Do you know what bar mitzvah was? It was the celebration of a young man turning 13. And they bar mitzvahed him. They had a special party and celebration, and it was called his bar mitzvah. Do you know what bar mitzvah means? Bar is the word for son, and mitzvah is the word for commandment. It meant this young man is becoming a son of the commandment. That is enormously theologically significant. Because in Jewish theology, obedience to the commandment was the way to heaven. It was the way to be related to God. You were going to be justified by God by your obedience to His commandments. So for you to be bar mitzvahed meant that you were going to become a son of the commandment. You were going to buy into the theology of justification before God on the basis of your good deeds, your obedience to His laws. That was fundamental to Jewish theology by the time Paul came along. It was his theology until he met Jesus on the road to Damascus before grace opened his eyes. So sonship for the Jew had to do with this whole business of human performance issues. And Paul is arguing all the way through Romans, that'll kill you dead as a hammer. Because the bottom line is, you're a sinner. You cannot keep the commandments. And if you want to stand before God and argue that you've kept His commandments, you're going to lose the argument. And not only that, you'll perish in the day of wrath. So, Paul is dealing with this whole business of the Son and the Father and what is the issue, and in direct contradiction to the Jewish bar mitzvah concept where, you know, sonship was by obedience, Paul has argued that that's a total failure. Sonship by obedience is a total failure. And he's wanted all along to show that you have to properly identify the Son because you have to properly identify the characteristic of the Father that the Son is the mimic of. And so that's the reason he raised the question in verse 1, what did the Father discover in relation to this business of acquiring the status of a son before God? What did Abraham discover? Well, Abraham could have discovered, according to verse 2, the justification was by good deeds, by your performance. But he didn't discover that, because that would have led to boasting. And nobody can boast before God. So that's not his discovery, verse 2. What is the discovery? Verse 3. He discovered that when you believe God, he reckons it to you for righteousness. Bang! That's the issue. Abraham discovered that justification before God was rooted in believing what he told you. So that justification is by faith. God said to Abraham, look at the stars, enumerate them if you can, that's the way your seed will be. Abraham believed it, and God reckoned it to him for righteousness. That's what the Father discovered. Now, if that's true, then the Father characteristic of Abraham is believing. And anybody who wants to be a son of Abraham is going to have to mimic that. Now, you can be like Isaac if you want to and mimic something else Abraham did a couple of times. You remember? He lied to a couple of kings about the identity of his wife. So is it any surprise that in the story of Isaac, we discover that Isaac lies to a king about the identity of his wife? Oh no, we're not surprised. He's a son of Abraham. But not at the level of faith. He's mimicking something that his father did. Shows that there's a connection there. But that's outside of the boundaries of Paul's argument, because Paul is not interested in whether you're a son of Abraham because you mimic the way he limps, or that you're the son of Abraham because you grow your beard just like he did, or that you're the son of Abraham because something else he did you do. That's the issue of father and son, is that. What is the issue to mimic? But the issue is, what did Abraham discover? He discovered when you believe God, God counts it to you for righteousness. That's the chief characteristic of the Father. That's why Abraham is said to be the father of those who believe. Because he is the original quintessential believer. He's the one who discovered the principle in its most fundamental and biblical framework. And I want us to understand this clearly, because Paul's argument's a little bit complex here in verse 11 and 12. His basic issue is establishing Abraham's father characteristic. And so he's bringing this father characteristic into focus. He's done it by quoting Genesis 15:6 and in Romans 4:3 and again in 9. But he's now arguing it on the basis of the circumcision-uncircumcision debate. Because the circumcision claim that you become the son of Abraham by bar mitzvah. You become a son of the covenant, a commandment. You get circumcised according to the covenant God made with Abraham, and that makes you a son of Abraham. And Paul is saying, that's not what Abraham discovered. You don't become a justified child of God by following Abraham's circumcision thing for a couple of reasons. And the first one is, you're not following Abraham's example anymore. If you think that by circumcision you become a son of the Father, because that's not what Abraham discovered. You see, Abraham was justified before God. He became a son of God by faith. And then, time developed later, he was circumcised. So you cannot turn that around without messing up the pattern. Abraham's pattern was, believe God, be justified, and then enter into this covenant thing. And you cannot turn that around and say, if you enter into this covenant thing, that'll enable you to become a believer and justified or whatever. But that's exactly what the Jews are trying to do. Now, I want you to notice that God, in the covenant with Abraham on circumcision, made it impossible for anybody who was following the covenant procedure to ever be a son of Abraham based on the circumcision issue. How so? Well, in the first place, Abraham was a believer before he was circumcised. But the covenant that God gave him about circumcision was, you get circumcised, circumcise all the males in your household, and then from then on, every time a male is born in your household, you circumcise him on the eighth day. Which means that any parent that's following the covenant requirement is circumcising their son long time before he ever becomes a believer. So he can never be a son of Abraham based on his circumcision. Because the order is out of order. He's not mimicking Abraham's example. That's the crucial issue of Paul raising this whole question, verse 10. How was it reckoned? Was it reckoned when he was circumcised or when he was uncircumcised? And the answer is uncircumcised. Okay, there's the pattern. Faith precedes the performance issue. You cannot turn that around and still be a son of Abraham because you've messed up the pattern. So basically, Abraham's fatherhood is the bottom line issue, but the bottom line issue in relation to that is what Abraham discovered, and that is faith precedes performance issues. And the reason for it was, according to verse 11 and 12, God had this plan that Abraham would be the father. He would be the father of the believer who was uncircumcised, and he would be father of the circumcised who was also a believer. In other words, it was the believing thing that made a person a son of Abraham. Circumcision had nothing to do with that. You can't copy Abraham's example as a male unless you only submit to circumcision after you've been a believer for a while. And that's not within the boundaries of the covenant of circumcision. You're supposed to be circumcised at 8 days. So see, you can never be. God made sure that you could never understand that you are the son of Abraham by circumcision because he's the one that turned it around. Having given it to Abraham after faith, he turned around and made all of the circumcised be circumcised before they could even be believers. And so God made sure that nobody could legitimately misunderstand and think that by circumcision they could become a son of Abraham. And historically, that's the way it worked. We said this last week, or maybe the week before, but if you were not of one of the 12 tribes of Israel, you could do all the believing and circumcising you wanted. You could stand on your head in the corner or do what. You would never inherit the land. If you became a believer in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as a Gentile, you could submit to circumcision if you wanted to. But that still wouldn't make it possible for you to inherit anything in the land because the land was already divided among the tribes and they passed the land on through the generations of the tribes. And if you weren't there, you didn't get it. It'd be like somebody saying, well, Daryl, when you die, are you going to leave your house and 3/4 acre to your children? That is, assuming that my wife's gone before me. Are they going to get it? Well, sure they are. Well, what would it take for you to let somebody else be an heir with them? Somebody from outside, one to be like your sons and daughter? I said, that ain't going to happen. Well, that's the way it was in Israel. If you wanted to be an heir of the land, which was what the covenant of circumcision was about, you had to be in the lineage of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the 12 sons of Jacob. And if you weren't in that lineage, you didn't get to inherit in the land. And if you weren't circumcised in that lineage, you were cut off from the people, and then you couldn't be an heir of the land. So the whole circumcision issue had to do with a national heritage called the land of Canaan. Abraham, in the plan of God, was going to be the father of the uncircumcised, which meant all those other nations that had no heritage in the land of Canaan. And he was going to be the father of those whose inheritance was going to be the land of Canaan, and two things had to be true of them. Number one, they had to be circumcised. Because that was a covenant requirement. If you weren't circumcised, you cut off from the people, you kicked out of the land, you didn't get any inheritance in the land. But the key issue was, having been circumcised, did you ever come to the characteristic of Abraham? And that is faith. Because if you don't come to that, you're not going to inherit the land either. Because if you're not forgiven by God, when the day of judgment comes, you will be destroyed rejected from everything, and that means you'll never inherit in the land any more than maybe just temporarily. So Paul's argument is pretty airtight. He's arguing sonship on the basis of following a key characteristic, and the characteristic that he highlights is the characteristic of faith, not circumcision, because God himself turned that around so it couldn't be misunderstood, and yet men in their brilliance misunderstood it anyway. They turned it around in spite of God's effort to keep it from being twisted. So Paul makes Abraham's chief characteristic faith. Do you believe what God has promised you? If you believe it, you have mimicked the characteristic that makes you offspring of the Father. It makes you a mimic of the original pattern. If you don't believe the promise that God has promised, then you have not mimicked the characteristic of the Father, and you can claim to be one of Abraham's offspring until you're gasping your last gasp, and Jesus will say of you, just like he did to those who didn't believe him, you're of your father the devil. He was a liar, and he didn't believe the truth from the beginning, and you're just like him. So that's what he's doing. Paul eliminates behavior considerations from the justification issue because they were eliminated by God with Abraham. He did not come to Abraham and say, you see all those stars? I'll make your seed like that if you'll do this and this and this and this and this. He just said, Abraham, you see all those stars? That's what I'm going to make your seed like. And Abraham believed him. And God justified him. So any behavior that precedes faith is outside the boundaries of the characteristic of faith and Abraham's believer, and any behavior that follows the faith is outside the boundaries of the divine response because God justified before the behavior fell into place. So his argument is pretty sound and solid in this regard, that Abraham received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith, which he had while he was uncircumcised, and he had it while he was uncircumcised so that he could become the father of those who believe without being circumcised. And, in verse 12, he was the father of the circumcision to those who are not only circumcised, but also believe like he believed when he was uncircumcised. So faith is the thing. And it doesn't matter, Jew or Gentile. The only people that are true sons of Abraham, and that is the only people who are going to be identified with the plan of God through that is going to flow through Abraham, are the ones who mimic the one thing that Abraham did that becomes the outstanding characteristic, and that is he believed the promise of God. Now, the question that really does kind of niggle at the back of your brain all this time is, I thought God is our Father. Why is Abraham being made the father of those who believe? What's the deal here? Well, stop and think about it a minute. How can you ever be the son of a father without a chief identifying characteristic? And what would it have to be if God were the father? I mean, which one would you choose? You can't say that you're the son of the heavenly father because he believed first and you believed like he did afterwards. You can't say that because God isn't a believer. Nobody made any promises to him that he had to believe. So, in trying to establish the characteristic, the original pattern and the follower pattern for the fathers and the son, or the father and the sons, God had to use somebody who could be the pattern, and that had to be a human being. And so he decided way back when that he was going to make Abraham the father of those who believe. Abraham is going to be the quintessential believer. And anybody who believes like Abraham believed is going to have the same result that Abraham had, and that is justification by faith. Adam was the original sinner, and we all sin because we're sons of Adam. Abraham was He wasn't the first believer. I mean, we have Enoch and probably Methuselah and Seth and a bunch of people before the flood that died before the flood. We have basically eight people coming through the flood. We assume they were all believers. Why didn't God use them? Well, part of the answer to that has to do with God's whole program of revealing the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis 12 as the pattern for the control of history from then on. The Abrahamic covenant in Genesis chapter 12 is the dominating theological construct that governs all of human history from that point on. Everything that happens after Genesis 12 is an outworking of the covenant God made with Abraham the believer. And because of that, God made Abraham the believer. He wasn't the original first believer, but he was the quintessential believer. He's the one that God chose to use as an example of what it means to believe me. God says, this is what it means to believe me. Abraham demonstrated that. So the father characteristic of Abraham is a faith response to a central divine promise, and when a person believes the promise of God, he becomes a son of Abraham. Does that stir up any questions that are unclear in your mind that you want to raise at this point? It completely dominates and controls all of human history. God is pouring human history through the Abrahamic covenant. Nothing is happening nowadays, and nothing has happened since Genesis 12 that has not been governed by the promises God gave to Abraham. We had the land promise, we had the seed promise, and we had the great name promise. The land promise found its outworking in the history of Israel for 2,000 years. The seed promise has had another 2,000 years of outworking in which the Son of God, the seed of Abraham, came and he started his church, and we have all become the seed of Abraham, the seed of God, the sons of God, by faith in the Son of God. And for 2,000 years, the promise of the seed has been focused on in the history of the church. So the land was focused on in the history of Israel, the seed was focused on in the history of the church, and the Bible prophesies a 1,000-year reign of Messiah in which the great name promise will be magnified, and people will have status in the eyes of God by virtue of the Son of God ruling in Jerusalem for 1,000 years. And so for 1,000 years, the focus will be on the great name promise. All of history from Genesis 12 till now, and for another 1,000 years and some, depending on when Jesus sets up his kingdom, is governed by those three promises. And in history, it's demonstrably so. Okay, any other questions, or is that just stirring up the mud? Well, it does. But the reason it gets so lost is because it's not been a part of our theological construct or even our thinking to primarily relate to Abraham as the father, as a believer, because in our orientation theologically, we're told, you know, believe in Jesus or accept Jesus or ask Jesus in your heart and all this eternal stuff is settled, and Abraham's not even in the picture by and large. He's just one of those Old Testament stories that you may or may not have even heard. But in the Bible, Abraham is so crucial, because God said, Abraham's going to be the man that I'm going to pour my covenant out to, and then history is going to be poured through that covenant for all the rest of human history. Abraham's the key guy, and that's why he was the friend of God. He understood his high privilege, and he responded properly and became God's friend. As we mimic that, we can become the friends of God. Then we'll be twofold more the sons of Abraham. But the real issue in sonship is, do you believe the promise? That's what made Abraham a son. That's what makes us sons. Okay, anything else? Okay, well, that ought to give you something to chew on for a week. Let's have a word of prayer together. Fathers, we think about the kinds of arguments that Paul set out, we're not surprised that they sound a little strange to our ears, because we haven't even thought along these lines for the most part. And yet, it's so clear once we see it that what you're looking for are people who will believe you when you speak. That's what you found with the man Abraham, and that's what you're still looking for. We know that you seek people who will respond to you with faith. And we want to be among that number who have enough confidence in the things you said to trust you. So we pray that you will build this confidence into us as we interact with your word, by your spirit, and with your people. And we ask this in the name of your Son, who made all this possible. Amen.